session number 27342, Reel 3.
Jack Thomas, Reel 3.
Well, then we got onto more advanced kinds of flying, where you really had to, where you passed the basic stage of being able to control the aircraft, but you had to find out what the aircraft could do and what it couldn't do. For instance, things like learning to get out of a spin. Now, spinning, there's always something kind of a magic about spinning. I remember in my reading my Biggles days about the dangers of spins and how people kill themselves in spins. Well, you could quite easily kill yourself in a spin in a tiger moth. A tiger moth is not a simple aeroplane to fly, because as a trainer, it's got to have enough vices to make it tricky enough for people to learn how to cope with the vices before going on to a perhaps simpler side of aircraft. So spinning was quite dramatic the first time, and you're actually horrified at this, the whole world spinning round about us. But after a while, you got to the habit where you did it as an exercise, and you went up fairly high to start with, so you had plenty of time to get out of it, spinning. And then aerobatics. And aerobatics is totally different from being taking part in the aerobatic manoeuvre than watching it. When you see it, see a plane of aerobatics, like say the Red Arrows, you see these planes performing graceful movements and turns and patterns in the sky. When you're in the aeroplane doing it, it's totally different. You're sitting there and you're doing things with this aeroplane, and the world's moving all around you, and you've no concept of what it looks like at all from the outside. A loop, for instance, which looks a very graceful but rather kind of tricky thing, is a very simple operation. You just stick the nose down. When you've got the right amount of speed up, you pull the stick back. The main thing to be careful is your wing is a level on the horizon as you go up. You go over the top. As you go over the top, you just ease it out again like that. It's comparatively simple, although it looks a tricky thing. But the trickiest ones are rolling, because when you roll the plane, with the Tiger Moth in particular, with not a very powerful engine, you've got to get a good bit of speed up, get the nose up, turn the plane over, and as you're turning it over, your controls are sort of going the other way around, so you get upside down and then back round again. And again, you're in the middle of this aeroplane, and as you get upside down, the dust from the bottom of the cockpit falls on you. So those are the things you feel, a sort of discomfort, and this curious sensation of the plane, the horizon moving around you, then you come out again. And most of the aerobatics are like that. The one which feels like it looks like, if you understand what I mean, is doing a stall turn, where you gracefully pull the nose up till the plane slows down, you let it fall away gently sideways till the speed builds up again, pulls away. It feels like it looks. But other aerobatics don't, and that's the big thing about it, I think.
With spinning, how do you get out of a spin?
Out of the spin, you put on, you close the throttle, full opposite rudder, pull back on the stick. That's it, basically. Once it stops turning, then you ease the stick forward, centralise the rudder, and you're flying again. What it is, as you're flying the plane, you get to what they call the stalling speed. And when it stalls, most planes will drop a wing when it stalls. And if unless you're quick, it will turn into a spin. The thing about the swordfish later on was that it wouldn't spin, which made it dangerous after flying swordfish. Anyway, that's by the side. But with the Tiger Moth, it was quite definitely going to spin quite easily, but as I said, that was necessary, because any aircraft could spin, and an uncontrolled spin could be very dangerous. A dangerous type of spin is an inverted spin, where rarely a plane will go into that, but that's the opposite, where you go over the top and you're going down and you feel as if your eyeballs are coming out. You've got to there do the exactly opposite. You push the stick forward and put on the same rudder. It feels all wrong. I've only once done an inverted spin long time later. But they didn't encourage that, because it does a lot of damage to the aeroplane. It can do with the forces moving the wrong way. So we carried on doing aerobatics, and we did a little bit of air navigation exercise. We did a bit of instrument flying, where they put a hood over the cockpit and... I'm out of context here. So we did this various type of flying, and then we did went solo, and this was the great thing when you get into the aeroplane for yourself. It's always unexpected. I was getting a bit worried. I'd done 13 hours, and they reckoned if you didn't go solo by 13 hours, you were out. And I had a good instructor, who's a Canadian flight lieutenant. And I remember he didn't always have the same instructor, but he was the one that was with me most of the time. And I know he used to say to me, okay, Tommy, get into number 62 and get the cat fan a weaving. That was at the start of it. Now, it's sealant. There's the main aerodrome, and around the back, there's a maintenance unit that had a small grass field there. And he says, okay, Tommy, we're going to enter 42 MU this morning. So we went into the MU field, landed there, and we did a couple of circuits. And then he said, tell you what, Tommy, he says, I think I'll go and have a cup of coffee. You take the kite round. Just once, he said, once round, then land it once, and then that's it, okay? That's it. That sort of suddenly came the other day, you see. And suddenly, the plane's very empty. There's nobody's head in front of you. You've got this empty space. And you think, now, what about now? I must remember what I've got to do. Well, I know how to fly. I can do it all right. For instance, various things you remember, like you cut the throttle when the green turns to grass. That was one thing we've been told. That's how you know how high you are above the ground. And all these things, you think, will I remember all this? And of course, then you get it anyway, then you take off. And you're so busy with thinking about what you're doing at the time. I don't remember being frightened at all or feeling as if this was something fantastic. Yet it was, I must get this right. It's, I'm doing an exercise and get it right. You go down onto the line up with the T in the right direction of the windsock, open the throttle, brakes on, open the throttle, then let the brake off, and off you go, rolling down, tail up into the air. Oh, just come up quickly, less weight, you see. Up you go, climb over Summers Ironworks. Don't forget, you go up in the air with hot air over there, come round in a circuit. When you get on the downwind leg, turn gradually, turn in, lose height, 800 feet, come in gradually, throttle back, come in, throttle right down, and just before you get, there we are, coming down to the grass, the green's turned to grass, right, cut the throttle down, bump, bump, bump me down, and taxi in. And then you suddenly realise, I've done it, I've been on my own, in an aeroplane, by myself, you know, and there's the instructor saying, go on, Tommy, okay, you're all right now then, right? Okay, we're going to do some aerobatics now then, and went up to get straight back into ordinary flying again, so you didn't sort of just sit and think about that particular thing. And then you did a mixture of dual and solo flying for the rest of the time.
How did you feel after you'd soloed?
Oh, 10 feet tall, you know, to walk in. The other people, went into the people in the crew room, you know, I've done it, I've been there, I've done it, you know, great. And those who had, we all felt we'd won ahead, and the people who hadn't yet done it were sort of looking at us, you know, we'd achieved the status of gods, you know, sort of thing. Oh, it was fantastic afterwards, yes, really.
And one of the other things you mentioned there was taxiing.
Yes.
How do you taxi the Tiger Moth?
With some difficulty, because you just have to push the rudder and give blast of throttle to get it moving along, because there's no braking system on the Tiger Moth, so it's quite tricky, really. So you've got to be careful, very careful. Yes, it's like all these things, it becomes a habit almost as you do it. You have to remember in the Tiger Moth, as we did later in the Swordfish, you must zigzag all the time because your nose is in front of you. You can't see out. Like a lot of modern aircraft, pilots are up in the front and they can see in front of them. But with the Tiger Moth, you can't. So you've got to be very careful to make sure you're not going to run into something. Yes. And you just give little blips on the throttle to keep it moving, you see. Then close the throttle down at the right time, the right moment.
Did you practice forced landings?
Yes, we did. Yes, we used to go in a... There's a field which is still there in Little Sutton, actually. We used to practice forced landings there where you... They were very keen on this, actually, because, in fact, you often did, as part of your training in dual anyway, they made you do a dead stick landing where you close the throttle, you weren't allowed to touch the throttle till you're back on the ground again. In an emergency, the instructor would have opened up, you see. But you did a lot of that because this is the thing. The great thing they told you as well, if your engine cuts on takeoff, land straight ahead. Don't try and turn and come back. You'll spin and you'll stall and spin and kill yourself. Land straight ahead. And don't forget, the aircraft can take an awful lot of crunch. As long as there's a reasonably flat bit of ground, you can get it down on, you're probably okay. Because the landing, I can't remember now, I suppose about 40 knots or something like that would land. So it's not very fast, really. So you did practice forced landings in that way, yes, yes.
With the forced landings, is there anything to try and look for if you have to make one?
Yes, what you're looking for a field, obviously, first of all, looking to make sure there's no high tension cables, telephone wires around the place, no tall trees on the incoming end, that it's not ploughed land, that it's not a tall crop like wheat, because you know what the ground's going to be like. You look for a grass field, really, fairly flat. You need a couple of hundred yards or something like that to land in it to be safe. But a tiger moth, you didn't need a very big field really at all. It was quite all right, that. The idea was to make sure that, as I say, that you got the plane down in one piece and didn't kill yourself, yes. But a tiger moth glided very well, actually. It glided nicely, you know, at a fairly steep angle, but a constant angle. And you could, if you timed it well, as you came down towards the ground again, you'd flare out and land it quite nicely, a three-point landing.
Were you instructed on how to restart the engine in the air?
Yes. I can't remember much about that, but we did exercise in that. Well, they stopped, which was horrifying the first time it happened. But he said, well, stop the engine. Poof, there's a silly propeller looking at you, you see. And you dived down and you switched off, and you dived down and then you switched on, and it started itself very easily, actually. It was a very simple starting procedure. But I didn't like flying without engines.
So after the soloing, the training would intensify, would it?
Yes, and you went to, let's say, more advanced form of flying, did some formation flying, you did your aerobatics and so on, and then you had to, at the end, you had to pass out, you had a chief flying instructor's test to make sure you're up to standard for going up the next stage, you see. And quite a few people dropped out at that stage, either didn't solo or weren't confident enough, or obviously didn't show the right sort of promise, I suppose. But it was terribly disappointing. I mean, it was the thing that hung over you like the sword of Damocles, this, all the way through your training. I can recall it now, and I think about it, it makes me go cold. It all the time it was there. What if I don't manage? Because they told us one thing. They said, by the way, if you dip anyway through the course, you will, of course, lose your status as sort of officer cadets, but if you want to guarantee get a commission, if you dip here, if you volunteer for coastal forces, you'll definitely get a commission. Because the attrition rate was so dreadful in that, you know, they didn't offer you anything to go into that. So one or two people, I think, must have gone in for that. But
you touched on the fact that you did instrument flying.
Yes.
Could you give me how that was instructed to you?
Yes, I don't remember much about it, because we did a lot more on Harvards later on, and that's blotted this out in my mind to some extent. But as far as I remember, in the Tiger Moth thing, there was a hood pulled over the cockpit, and the instructor told you what to do. We just did very little of this, really, but you had to fly on your instruments only. And the great thing to remember was there, as in all instrument flying, that you ignore your senses. That's the most important thing. Because in a cloud or any situation, you can feel as if you're moving in one direction, you're moving in another. You watch the instruments and they tell you. If you feel you're going down to the turning to the left, look at the instruments. If they say you're straight ahead, you're straight ahead. If they say you're going to the left, you are. Pull it up again. Ignore any other feelings. And this is the whole purpose of it. The rate of climb, the other instrument, the rate of climb indicator. You watch your rate of climb, you watch your turn and bank, you watch your airspeed, you watch your revs, and you make sure that these instruments are all that you take notice of. Because it's so easy to get disorientated, and your senses will tell you one thing and your feelings say one thing, and you're totally wrong. And that's the difficult stage, as I say, when we did a lot more, we just did a sort of familiarisation there, but later on we did it more definitely. You had to really make sure that was absolutely important, because it came into night flying apart from anything else. We had one trip up at night as a passenger to show what it was like flying at night in the Tiger Moth, but that was it. We didn't do night flying as such.
What was it like in that trip?
Well, weird really, because there you were, odd few little lights about on the ground, not very many, the cockpit instruments glowing at you, the sparks coming out of the engine. Again, this feeling of isolation, much more so, because there you were, you know, there's nothing looked right at all. And the runway, they didn't have a runway, they had gooseneck flares, which was a paraffin flare lamp set down intervals down the edge of the strip where you're taking off. And when you came into land, there wasn't much to see. I mean, you know, the instructors obviously were experienced with this, but it was rather frightening, that. I didn't really look forward to night flying after that exercise.
What about cross countries?
We did one cross-country flight, a solo one, where we had to fly to I flew to Elmden. No, I did two, that's right. One, I flew to Elmden, and I had to land there, go to the control tower and get my logbook signed, and then fly back again to show I'd actually been there, you see. And then another one I had to do, we did a triangular one where we flew, and I remember flying, it was quite interesting because I flew home to Durham from across and back again down from there in a triangular flight, yes. And that was interesting. And I enjoyed that. I really enjoyed the cross-country flying because you navigated from a map and you knew what your wind was, and you sort of made allowances for the wind. It was fairly basic. It was really dead, visual flying. When you did it when the weather was good, and you were flying at about between 1,000 and 2,000 feet, so you could recognise the land, you see, recognise things. So it wasn't navigation in that sense. It was basic flying, where you flew from place to place. The most interesting thing about this is when you're flying, there's a map. You're flying over a map when you're flying over the ground, because the ground is flattened out by your height. It's pretty big hills before you see them at all. It's rather remarkable, that. But important things like railway lines and main roads, reservoirs, anything like that, towns, of course. And, of course, you can get lost. One or two people did on the course, get lost and do a forced landing somewhere and go and ask somebody the way. Then they usually sent another plane out with an instructor and they flew them both back, you see. One or two people are odd people who occasionally heard of somebody who did land miles from anywhere, and he went and found out where he was. Anyway, he got somebody to give him a hand to push the plane back to the edge of the field, and persuaded someone to swing the propeller for him, and he took off and flew back. And he was not recommended. He's highly chastened for doing such a thing. Shouldn't have done that.
Yeah. You mentioned formation flying as well. Uh-huh. What kind of degree of formation flying did you go in?
Not very much, just a little bit. As far as I remember, I think we only did that with instructors in Tiger Moths. Yeah, probably. I think only with instructors and dual control. Because you have to be careful not to get too close and lock your wings or anything like that. We didn't want to get too close anyway. And we're nothing like the Red Arrows, you know, just merely staggering around in groups of three. Yes, very, very, very basic stuff. But you learn to fly. You learn, and you got past the stage when you finished there of thinking about what you were doing with your hands and feet and things, and you operated the aeroplane. So that was the great thing. You got to that stage of proficiency, and you were then ready to learn, not just to fly, but to be a pilot. So that's where the next thing came.
Mm. Can you give me a brief description of the Tiger Moth as an aircraft?
Very well, I can, yes, because as I say, I flew in one just over a year ago, and I'd forgotten what it felt like, really. Very light, very dainty. You handle it with sort of finger and thumb, really, on the stick and the throttle. It danced about in the air. Any air currents would move it. Indeed, the lightest of controls and touch. Unlike a lot of modern aircraft, where you're steering with the way you have a wheel, and you rarely use your rudder at all, you just turn the wheel to turn. You have to use your rudder in conjunction with the stick to get the right degree of, stop slipping and sliding, get the right degree of turn. Comfortable aeroplane to fly, very pleasant, and one in which you feel very much part of the aeroplane, because it is so small, it's just wrapped round you in a sense. Very satisfying, a nice chuckling sound from the engine. Yes, it's Great little aeroplane. I mean, there are thousands of them still flying now all over the world, really. Amazing. Yeah.
And what colours and markings were your Tiger Moths in?
Well, just sort of camouflage with RAF, ordinary RAF camouflage and a number on the side, as far as I remember. Just a sort of mottled camouflage covering with the RAF roundels on it, that's all, yes.
Would you have a yellow underside?
Do you know, I don't know, I can't remember. I know a lot of training aircraft were yellow, like the Harvards were yellow later on, but I honestly can't remember that. Nope, I never thought about it.
So at that stage, you'd obviously done an awful lot of training, elementary training.
Yes.
How did you feel when you completed that stage, and what was the next stage?
Well, the next stage was we were going to really learn to be fleet air arm pilots, not just flyers, but fleet air arm pilots. And we were going to go to Canada to learn to fly under the Empire Training Scheme, Kingston, Ontario. And then we went on the Queen Elizabeth, to cross to Canada. It's only a 3 or 4 day trip because the Queen Elizabeth went flat out travelling at fantastic speed. It was so fast that a torpedo couldn't keep up with it. So we thought we were quite safe anyway travelling across on this thing. And that was very good. The food was excellent on board. We lived in what had been state rooms. There were 18 of us in one of the state rooms, and in 6 3-tier bunks. I can remember that a little bit of a problem. The man in charge of the ship was a group captain of the RAF, as it happened. The different services took responsibility for different ships, you see. And he didn't appreciate the fact that a leading seaman in the Navy was not the same as a leading aircraft in the RAF, but a leading seaman was equivalent but senior to a corporal in the RAF, of course, or a corporal in the Army. And they wanted us to do the chores that the ordinary seaman did and the ordinary RAF recruits did, and we had quite a bit of a bother persuading that we didn't do such things, that wasn't our job. Anyway, that was all right. One thing that struck me is typical of the force is this: the panelling in the corridors are beautiful bird's eye maple, and on one of the corridors alleyways there was a 6-inch nail hammered in with a card hanging from it: "Do not deface the panelling." That is typical, I think, of the forces. So I remember saying that's certainly amazing. That. And funnily enough, they had a daily newspaper on the ship, which was published. And one day as we were going across, the copy of the paper was the report of the dam busters raid, and that was very. We thought, well, that's great, you know, that's fantastic. We heard something about really the war's getting a move on now, you know. And we sailed into New York, into the harbour at New York, and we're going up the East River past the Statue of Liberty. And these ships of all sorts of things into the dock there, and then we went from there. We went to Grand Central Station, and we got on a train which was going to take us to Moncton in New Brunswick, which was a sort of distribution centre. And I think it was about a couple of days on the train. They had bunks that pulled down; you could sleep on the train. And of course, I think once you got to America and Canada, the food suddenly was there. Rationing was forgotten. We saw white bread for the first time for years, you see. Things like ice cream, steaks, incredible. You know, we'd never seen anything like this. Fantastic. We had this train journey across to Moncton, where we were for a short time, and then we transferred on another train and went to Kingston, Ontario, the Royal Canadian Air Force Station, where we did our SFTS, which is service flying training, on Harvard's. And this was another big step forward. Here were these aeroplanes that looked like real aeroplanes. You know, I mean, like, I know they weren't Spitfires and Hurricanes, but the same size as them, and a bit bigger, in fact. Very chunky, formidable-looking aeroplanes. And we did our time there. We were there in, exactly, it was from, when was it now? Oh, about June to October. So we were sort of summer trainees, which is quite a good thing. Some people went there in the winter and they had all the experience of flying from snow-covered runways and everything. Well, we never saw anything of that. We had the summer and the heat instead, where the biggest danger was getting sunburnt in the cockpit. In fact, it was a crime to be sunburnt in the RAF. You had to wear open neck. You had to wear short-sleeve shirts. You had to keep your shirt buttoned up. We went into a strange uniform there. We were the only people in the Navy dressed like that. We wore khaki slacks, khaki shirts, and khaki ties, with our naval round pillbox hats with the white hat bands. Now, anybody else in the Navy who was wearing khaki always wore a black tie for some reason, but we wore khaki ties, so we were unique in that sense. And we wore our naval badges on these khaki uniforms. We wore our naval uniforms when we went ashore into Kingston, to the town, or went on leave, but otherwise we wore all these khakis all the time. The training became very much more intense here. And the subject was treated as quite seriously. I mean, they were quite dealt with in an academic way. The theory behind everything we'd learned before was much more intense. The navigation, you did proper navigation exercises where you had to lay on winds, lay off winds, apply course corrections and everything like that. Your meteorology became quite scientific, and we did armament as well, where you learnt about the various types of armaments and bombs and machine guns and things, and how they worked and why they worked and everything else as well. We had a lot of theoretical work as well as the practical side. And when we had before we had our WIGS exam at the end, you had your theoretical exam, which was quite stiff, really. Quite a few people dipped on that. People perhaps hadn't been used to learning, in a sense, you know. It was quite academic, that side of it.
What happened to the people who dipped at this
stage? Well, they vanished. This is the sort of sad thing about it. They vanished from your life. You never knew what happened to them. Occasionally, perhaps, you'd meet someone later on who dipped, but I never met very many at all. They just sort of vanished. This is awful thing that, you know, they left your world altogether. And there was quite a big culling at this particular stage.
Was there a reason why they vanished so quickly?
Well, I suppose when they got to the stage where they felt they weren't going to be able to succeed in completing the course to the satisfactory level, they were then, in a sense, of us, the Navy was concerned, a waste of money at the expense of the course, you see. It's a sad thing, but that was it.
Would they be worried that if they were hanging around for a day or so, though, they might spread?
No, they usually went straight away. They usually went off very quickly, but the next day they vanished, sort of thing. The kit was gone and they were away. It was almost like as if they'd died. And there was one person killed on the course after mine. Stan Brand was on it, actually. Stan had he went on two different courses because I think he had appendicitis or something. He dropped from one or the other. And I think one of the people on his course was killed, yes. We had my most... interesting incident was my first crash was at Kingston. My first step towards an Iron Cross, which I never got, although I destroyed 5 British aircraft in my career. I mean, a German, I'd have had an Iron Cross for that.
Well, can you take me through what happened?
There's two Harvards, right. Well, I was flying with instructor in the back, actually, but it was the fault, really, of the person who was controlling the takeoffs and landings. They worked with an Aldis lamp, with a green and a red Aldis lamp for takeoff or don't, you know, or stop or start, with a little control van at the end of the runway. Well, he'd given me the green to come in to land, and he'd also given somebody else a green to take off. And the chap taking off was rather slow taking off. And I landed behind him, and I was going faster than he was landing, as he was taking off. And my propeller was getting nearer and nearer to his tail, and I think he was beginning to sweat when he saw me in the mirror, and straining forward his strap somewhat. So we hit this plane, we locked together, we did a fantastic sort of cartwheel across the aerodrome. I can remember time stood still, and the only thing that went through my mind was, this is a fantastic noise, you know, great, wow, bang, wallop, you know. Never that, didn't think about being hurt at all. This awful, tremendous, noisy, fairground experience. We went round, then we came to a juddering halt. The two Harvards written off, and the only trouble was the one that I was flying was the chief flying instructor's pet Harvard, and my instructor got an endorsement in his logbook, and it wasn't his fault because we flew in the front seat in the Harvard, the observer, the instructor in the back, and he couldn't possibly have seen from where he was, and I couldn't see because of the big nose anyway, till I got right down on the ground. It was really the fault of the chap on the runway, but anyway, I say he got an endorsement, I didn't. But I wasn't very popular with the chief flying instructor. And I know later on, when I come to do my WIGS exam, WIGS test, I was very worried in case he bore a grudge against me, spoiling his nice new aeroplane.
To what degree was there an investigation about what had happened at that?
Oh, we were all... Everybody concerned was questioned about it, what happened. But it was fairly obvious, really, what had happened. But technically, the instructor should have been... alert enough to have noticed that something was going on. That's how they saw it. I'm sorry for it. He was only a young chap. He was only 21 years old himself. I thought he was much older man than that. I was only 18, you see. But the Harvard was although apart from that crash, it was a very nice aeroplane to fly. It was, again, when we got in, we did the same thing, familiarisation with it. You were given the handling notes to read in detail because it was much more complicated. We had things like a boost control, which you didn't have on the Tiger Moth. And you had all these instruments to do with the firing machine guns and cameras and dropping bombs and everything else. And the whole feel of it, again, was different. Again, it had that nice aeroplane smell. As I say, it felt bigger. You felt you had more room in the cockpit. You felt you got power here. And when you did your, before you went solo, you did a bit of dual flying, and this, of course, as well, through all the same processes, but not so much, because you were obviously, you knew how to fly. You was getting the feel of this aeroplane. And it was just a much more powerful plane altogether. And it was very smooth to fly as well, very easily controlled. It was, in many ways, basic as an aeroplane to fly, a very easy plane to fly. Aerobatics were similar to the Tiger Moth, but it had more power, so it wasn't such a struggle to do them. You still had that same isolated feeling when you were doing them. We did quite a lot of formation flying, which was where you had to tuck in very close as well. That made you sweat a bit sometimes, particularly when we did things like crossover turns, where the chap of the leading aircraft would say, like, brake to port, brake to port, go. And you went, the whole flight changed over. You went over each other like that. And there were, so the sky was full of aeroplanes milling around. I really appreciate the Red Arrows and their difficulties, because and their what they do, because what they do is absolutely incredible. We never flew as close as that. Mm-hmm.